ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Many older Australians living in the country face a tough dilemma when they're ready to downsize their home. If they want to stay in their community, where can they live? Today in Australia Wide, we head to Winchelsea, a town in regional Victoria that's come up with an interesting solution.
In a way, it's creating housing for younger people too, because there'll be 10 couples or singles that'll move in here, which is freeing up 10 other bigger properties around town for younger people to move into. And it's quite different to some of the first home buyer ones, which do need financial subsidising assistance to get them underway. This doesn't need any financing, it just needs a loan arrangement which is user-friendly.
And a large survey finds Australians' faith in democracy is waning, especially if they live in the bush.
They don't listen to nobody. All they want is their payment at the end of the week.
Yeah, I guess it's we're fairly removed and distant geographically from federal politics, I think.
I don't feel they understand the conditions in rural Australia.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. Regional Australia is home to more than a third of the country's older residents. That's those aged over 65. Now, many older people in the country face a tough decision when they're ready to downsize their home. A scarcity of medium density housing in many regional locations means residents are forced to choose between staying on in a big home that no longer suits them or uprooting their life and moving from their community to find a smaller place. One community has found a solution that benefits both young and old. Kath McAleen has this story.
Margaret Reed has lived in this 1900s weatherboard home on the banks of the Barwon River in the western Victorian town of Winchelsea for 40 years. But now, aged in her 70s, the sprawling garden and home is getting too much to manage.
Plenty of weeds. Rabbits, I've got plenty of rabbits.
She feels lucky to have secured a new unit on a much smaller block close by.
It was important for me to stay here in town because I do have friends and I am involved with a couple of local groups. So it was important to stay here and keep that connection. I mean, to go to, say, Geelong or Colac or somewhere like that where I didn't really know anybody, I think would be a bit isolating for me.
According to the Regional Australia Institute, many older rural residents who want to downsize and stay in their local town are not able to. The Institute's recent housing report found growing demand for smaller unit-type accommodation, but more than 80% of homes in country towns are large family houses. It's a problem Margaret's community of Winchelsea identified a few years ago.
We'd had a couple of local residents that had bigger, older houses that were needing to downsize. They were having to go to Geelong or Torquay to retirement villages. The town lost valuable community contributors, and they kept coming back to meetings and things because they regretted having to leave Winchelsea. But it's good to be able to keep people that are contributors to a whole community, and that's probably what sparked the idea for a start.
That's Ken McDonald, a committee member of local charity Winanglo. It's just completed construction of 10 smaller units in the town centre for older downsizers. Margaret Reed was among the first to move in.
There are not many small units in Winchelsea. I think I would have struggled to find something smaller for me to live on. So when this came up, this was, you know, right from the start, this is where I wanted this.
This project has been years in the making and received support from the Surf Coast Shire, as well as initial financial backing from the local community bank. But the volunteer committee still faced obstacles in planning approvals and financing, and Ken McDonald thinks government assistance through a loan program could help other rural towns build something similar. He says it wouldn't just benefit older residents.
In a way, it's creating housing for younger people too, because there'll be 10 couples or singles that'll move in here, which is freeing up 10 other bigger properties around town for younger people to move into. And it's quite different to some of the first home buyer ones, which do need financial subsidising assistance to get them underway. This doesn't need any financing, it just needs a loan arrangement which is user-friendly.
Demographer Dr. Liz Allen says Australia's housing shortage has seen generations pitted against one another. But she believes a mismatch of housing where some people can't find the homes they need and others are living in houses that are surplus to their needs is the fault of policy and not baby boomers.
So while some might say, well, it's older folks sitting on a wealth of property and banking homes and banking land, that's just not the case. It is mighty difficult in Australia to ensure that people are in the right sized home, in the right location that meets their needs. And this especially impacts older Australians.
Back at the Winchelsea Village, last-minute work is underway on a shared barbecue area ahead of an official opening celebration. 90-year-old retired farmer Reg Stevens was the very first resident to move into this new housing development. When his wife passed away, he got lonely on the farm and he didn't want to make the move into a bigger nearby town like Geelong or Torquay, as others he knew have had to do. He feels fortunate that he'll see out his days in his home community.
What better can I get, actually? Know everyone, and it's just like home, really. I don't know, I just really don't know what I'd do other if this wasn't available, you know.
Retired farmer Reg Stevens, ending that story from Kath McAloon. And there was additional reporting there from Jeremy Story Carter.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Australians' faith in our democracy is waning, and no more so than in the bush. That's what a survey of almost 4,500 Australians has found. The report by independent researcher McKinnon asked participants a series of questions, and here's some of the examples. They asked, how much do you trust federal politicians? Does Australia's federal politicians understand and represent people like you? Or do you think federal politicians in Australia deliver and follow up and deliver on their commitments? Now, overall, the report by McKinnon found Australians' trust in politicians and democracy is waning. But in regional and remote Australia, confidence is slipping more dramatically. Professor Nicholas Biddle is the head of the School of Politics at the Australian National University. Now, Professor Biddle, the decline in confidence in democratic institutions is definitely a global phenomenon. It's not unique to Australia. Though in Australia, what's very noticeable is this marked divide between how people in the city feel and how people in the bush feel. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so first to put it in a global perspective, I think it is true, you're right, that Australia has kind of declined in some measures of kind of confidence and kind of satisfaction with democracy, but not as much as other countries. So that's one thing to be really clear, is that at least in an international perspective, Australia is doing reasonably well. But you're right. What is the real issue is not so much the national picture, which is pretty good in a comparative perspective, but parts of the country which may be doing worse than others or declining more than others. So while we weren't involved at the ANU in the McKinnon work, we have been working with them and chatting to them. We've been doing our own work looking at some of the drivers of satisfaction in democracy and confidence in institutions. And I'd say there's kind of three reasons why that regional kind of urban divide is emerging. One is because one of the key predictors of kind of confidence in institutions, trust in democracy, satisfaction in democracy is a person's level of education. So education is one of the key predictors of both confidence as well as voting patterns. And we know that in regional and remote areas, there tends to be relatively low levels of education, of course, with much variation compared to urban areas. And I think what that suggests to me is that the economy, the structures of our society aren't working as well for those in regional and there's lower levels of education, and that's more pronounced in remote and regional areas. So that's one. I think there are kind of regional specific issues which are driving the drop in confidence. And three, I think there's it's a party issue as well. So the party in government at the moment is not as represented as well in regional remote areas, and that tends to lead to a lower confidence.
Going back to that education issue, some of these things are self-fulfilling, aren't they? Because if there isn't access to education, then the population won't be as educated. So for somebody listening in the bush, they'd be like, well, you know, I don't have the opportunities of people in the city. So it's a circular type of thing, really.
No, I think it's more than that. I think it's what it is that as a country, we haven't been able to ensure that education opportunities are as evenly distributed across both geographically but also demographically. And what that means is not only are people missing out on the opportunities which education brings, but also that those who haven't had that access kind of see that the economy is not set up to kind of meet their needs and to you know, for those people to kind of see that there's a an economic future for them.
That also extends to other things like healthcare, of course.
Yeah, of course. So I think there's, and that's kind of the second part of it, which is there is kind of regional specific issues. One is kind of access to services, as you said. Another is, I guess the extent to which the current economic system is designed to support the types of industries which have historically predominated in kind of regional and rural areas. So yeah, I think they're all the kind of drivers are interrelated.
How big a part, though, does the fragmentation of local news have to play in how Australians in regional and remote Australia feel about how politicians represent them? Because that is a change that's happened and has crept in the last, say, decade.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I think there's two parts to that. One is that the extent to which there's a voice in regional and rural and remote areas, which allows people to kind of express the challenges, the views, and kind of see their issues being covered. So that's one part of it. I think two is that if people are reliant on news which is being written by and kind of broadcast from other parts of the country, they don't see their stories being told, and not just the kind of negative stories, but also positive stories are being told in the areas in which they live. So I do think that the consolidation of media into kind of urban-based media is likely to you know, shape what people in regional areas see about themselves and also their ability to represent themselves.
You alluded to the party issue, because across the political spectrum, the traditional base for a lot of political parties has shifted. You know, the Labour Party could be seen as city voters. The Liberal Party lost a lot of ground to the Teals in the last election. Do you think that shift in ground is reflected in this study?
Yeah, so I do think so. I think that the current government is predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly and represents urban electorates. And that has two impacts. One is a direct impact, which is that the representatives just design policies which kind of fit what they know and what they kind of experience. So there's a kind of a policy impact of that. But the second impact is that people, when they're answering questions about kind of confidence in government, trust in democracy, they are partly answering like a structural question, but they're also answering a political question. And what they're partly saying is that we don't trust the party which is not representing the areas in which we live.
Just going back to that sentiment, that's very much like, as I've gone through all the questions, you can see where the sentiment of regional voters are. And it did come up in the coverage on Australia Wide at the last federal election. Time and time again, people would say, we feel forgotten by Canberra, that they were the kind of forgotten voters, and that their lives were not really met with the same consideration of people living in the city, how their lives played out for them, like their access to a hospital or their access to education, the kind of roads they were driving on, all of those things. Do you think politicians, well, some would say they don't take note at all, or they only take note just before an election? What needs to be done to course correct so that regional voters feel included?
Yeah, look, I think there's a couple of things. One is that, as you said, there's kind of a media story to it, which is that there is unfortunately a lack of kind of representation of kind of regional and rural issues in the mainstream media and the media which is broadcast out of urban areas. So I think there is a continuous need to kind of invest in telling those stories. I mean one of the real challenges of current kind of political structure is the minor parties and those which represent which aren't kind of in power don't tend to have the same level of access to kind of question time or other aspects of engagement in political debate. So I think this is not a party issue. I don't think that this is Labor, Liberal or the Nationals. It's just a general issue, which is I think we need to set up our institutions so that those voters who are represented by non-major parties are able to see themselves being kind of reflected in kind of the debates of the day. And I do think that just in general, the economic structures which you or access issues which you talked about are their ongoing kind of challenges, which there's a public policy issue, not just a political issue. And I do think that it's challenging, it's difficult to provide the same level of services evenly across the country. But if those differences either remain or exacerbated, then it's understandable that people would not necessarily target their displeasure towards parties, but to the system as a whole.
Before I let you go, we're talking about this today because the McKinnon report came out and it found that Australians were a little bit shaky on how their democracy was going. But if we look at other wealthy democracies, I think it'd be fair to say people would say politics is something of a bin fire at the moment globally. This is your area of expertise and something you've spent a lot of time looking at. How do you feel about the future of democracy here in Australia particularly?
Yeah, look, I think we have a lot of things we should be very positive about. I think when we look comparatively in Australia, either when we compare the views of Australians to other countries or when we look at institutions in Australia compared to other countries, we have a very positive story to tell. I think Australia has managed both some of the economic challenges, but also through our political institutions, some of the political challenges which other countries have struggled with. But I think the message is democracy is not set and forget. Democracy is something which we need to continue to innovate, need to continue to identify where there's kind of institutional changes which are required, or where there's parts of the country which are not necessarily seeing the same benefits as others. So I think mostly a positive story, Australia compared to the rest of the world, but also we need to keep kind of looking at where we can continue to improve and continue to set the lead internationally in terms of how we structure our democracy.
Professor Nicholas Biddle, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
You're listening to Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. It's lovely to have your company today. Now, every day we bring you stories from the country brought to you by the ABC's largest network of regional journalists. We have reporters everywhere. Remember, you can always podcast the show or listen back to the programme through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC and Australia Wide. And you can always email us. We'd love to hear what's happening in your neck of the woods. australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. That's australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. Foreign-owned aquaculture company Tassal has suffered another fish kill, this time at its Barramundi farm in the waters off WA's Kimberley coast. The Canadian-based company owns large salmon farming operations in Tasmania, which has also been plagued by a mass die-off of fish farmed in pens in the ocean. This latest fish kill in the Kimberley comes at a bad time for the company, as it's proposing a major expansion of its Barramundi farm there. Paddy Manning has this story.
This has the potential to be really detrimental to the pristine environment up in the Buccaneer Archipelago.
Martin Pritchard is the director of conservation group Environs Kimberley. He's got images and video of a fish kill at Cone Bay on the Buccaneer Archipelago off the WA coast. It came from a whistleblower.
And what we're seeing is truckloads of dead barramundi being shipped and then driven to the Broome Tip and disposed of there, and there's tons and tons of dead barramundi that's headed there and being buried there.
When did you hear about this?
We heard about this a couple of weeks ago and had it confirmed by various people in the community. We're obviously really concerned because that part of the Buccaneer Archipelago is really special to people. People go out there fishing, they go out there camping. It's really important for traditional owners. So a lot of people are concerned about what's going on there, and they let us know that there was a mass fish kill happening at Cone Bay.
When do you think the fish kill started?
We've been told that it started about 5 weeks ago.
He estimates there's 100 to 150 tonnes of dead fish.
What we think is that when the public sees the footage, it's really clear that this is a mass fish kill event. The Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development may well have some kind of methodology or parameter that doesn't call it that. But for the average person to look at this, you can quite clearly see this is a mass fish kill. There's tons of dead barramundi being put in waste facilities and trucked from Cone Bay.
Aquaculture company Tassal confirmed there were lower than normal survival rates at Cone Bay in October. It's blamed a naturally occurring fish-specific parasite known as a blood fluke, which it says is influenced by lower than usual ocean temperatures. The state regulator is working with Tassal vets to prevent a recurrence, but Martin Pritchard wants an independent inquiry.
What we'd really like to know is what has caused the blood fluke in these farmed barramundi at Cone Bay. We need a really open, transparent inquiry into what's caused this mass fish kill up at the Buccaneer Archipelago.
Dr. Stephen Pycroft is president of the Aquatic Animal Health Chapter of the College of Veterinary Scientists.
I've spent the last 30-odd years doing aquatic animal health and fish pathology.
What is a blood fluke?
Okay, so they're a group of parasites that are common in fish. The blood fluke basically is part of a group of worms that has a sort of an adult stage in the host fish, and then it has juvenile stages which sort of get out of the fish. So the adults live literally in the vasculature or the blood vessels of the fish, and they lay eggs, and those eggs accumulate in various tissues. But to get back to the outside world, they then tend to accumulate in the gills. And so that causes damage to the gills, accumulation that stops the blood flow, etc. And then the eggs will break out of the gill tissue into the environment, whereby they will hatch, and a small little sort of swimming stage of the worm then finds another host, and that host is usually a mollusk, a snail, or a slug, that sort of group of organisms. It then gets into those organisms, it matures, it then busts out as an infective stage, and then finds the fish population, finds a fish, gains entry either by oral routes or by skin or gill routes, because there's a thin passage to the circulatory system, and then the whole cycle starts again.
He says blood fluke can be exacerbated by concentrating fish in pens.
Particularly if you've got a poor water quality that the fish aren't used to living with and it's changed acutely, then it will cause a significant response on a lot of fish because they are held together in that same environment.
He says blood fluke is safe for humans to eat and is treated with praziquantel, used in pet wormers?
Yes, basically the blood flukes themselves are species specific, and so they're a barramundi fluke, okay? And so if you were to cook your fish, there's no issue, to be honest. You know, even if you decided that sashimi, barramundi sashimi, was your space, they don't get into the... It's a different host. But, I mean, cooked fish, not a problem.
Hmm. Paddy Mining with that story, and that was Dr. Stephen Pycroft speaking to him. Councils in regional Western Australia continue to face challenges in attracting and retaining staff to serve their local communities. Now, it's a situation all too familiar to many regional towns across Australia. The rugged outback can feel isolating to some, but in Geraldton, in the Midwest of WA, a wave of Shire workers with unique backgrounds are stepping into the roles and celebrating all the country life has to offer. Geraldton reporter Piper Duffy has this story.
Similar mentality, similar craziness, you know, that sort of, you know, that feel of volunteering and everything and close family knit. So, and that's what brings me to here.
Adim Hajat is no stranger to small remote communities. Originally from the Cocos Keeling Islands, Mr. Hajat and his wife Manissa packed up their life to call WA's Midwest region home. Mr. Hajat works as the Perenjori Shire Community Development Officer and says similarities to his home island drew them to the humble town.
Community is very much more, you know, intimate, and relocating my family because they love being in smaller communities. And we flourish, you know, like through our, cooking is one of them, which we kind of really share with this community. And we kind of give that to, you know, help out with a lot of the seniors with regards to meals and all that kind of stuff, because we want to share our traditional ways. And we love that, being part of the smaller community.
Despite a population shift of people leaving their hometown in regional WA, Mr. Hajat says he's noticed other community development officers, like himself, move hundreds or thousands of kilometres to call the state's outback home.
Place like Karoo, I use out there, and I think she's Indonesian. And then you've got Rahman, who is Indian, and he's at Three Springs. And Muthri now in Morawa, which is great for us. You know, it's a different, diverse group. And similarities is that, you know, we're family orientated. We want to bring a bit of diversity and a bit of culture, a bit of something that we've learned over the years regarding community development and working in small remote communities.
Muthuri Marithi migrated from Kenya to WA before working as the Shire of Morawa's Community Development Officer. He says his international background has influenced his approach to the role.
It brings a whole unique perspective to community development when you're from somewhere else, because, like, just settling into the role, you know, each community is shaped by the different needs that it has, because you might be in a community such as Morawa, which is full of, like, the locals or farmers, and then you have the people who service the region, that's the teachers, the nurses, and the local government workers. They all have different needs. Regional towns are quite unique in their own way. They offer somewhere that's quiet. It also offers you the aspect of community. You feel like you belong once you sail in, because the community is small. You get to know people. You know, it's where you get to say hi to people when you're driving. People are waving at you in the morning. And it's just a different feeling.
WA Local Government Association President Karen Chappell says regional councils have to think outside of the box to attract and maintain staff.
There's a population shift that we know to larger centres, and we are also at all times competing with, you know, other industries. We have to, in local government and in any industry, we now have to think outside the square for our workforce recruitment. It's not easy. We have to offer, you know, many of us offer housing, which is, you know, a very generous employment incentive.
But Ms. Chappell says people like Mr. Hajat and Mr. Murithi are helping the regions grow.
They always seem to have good spirits and be willing to assimilate within in our communities and become part of it. And that's what rural communities do, though. Rural communities always, you know, they always welcome everybody. It doesn't matter, you know, what agency you come from or who you work for. It's sort of part of being part of your life in a small community is joining in. And these, I've found that these community development officers, they really embrace their life in country WA.
Piper Duffy reporting there from the Midwest of Western Australia. And that is Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. It's been lovely to have your company. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.